On the ninth day of the month of February, early in the year of a decade, not too long before our own, cinema found itself face to face with a podcast that would grow far beyond its humble beginnings. What started as something small, almost unremarkable, soon revealed itself to be a turning point, emerging, as these things often do, from the most unexpected corner of popular culture. Back on the row, words on a page. Howard was writing, sharp, dark and strange. Needed a sound, bright and alive. Enter Menken, key started to drive. Old sci-fi flicks, driving decay. Horror and comedy, folded in play. Small little show, big reaction. Off-Broadway hit, cult satisfaction. Songs tell the story, jokes cut like knives, characters sing to stay alive. Lights got bigger, cameras rolled. Same strange plant, story retold. Stage to the screen, same wicked flow. Ashman and Menken, that's how it grows. Puppets and film, shot by shot. Stage-born soul, never forgot.
Nonsense. Welcome to Movieversaries on Punch and Pie Media. I'm your host, Andy Williams. This is where we celebrate and sometimes re-evaluate some of the greatest movies ever on a significant anniversary. On this episode, we are discussing Little Shop of Horrors as it turns 40 years old. It's a candy-coloured musical that is way smarter and darker than it first looks. Between its doo-wop hooks and its puppetry, it's basically a Faustian story about capitalism, desire, and how people can trade their ethics for success. Obviously, that's why we wanted to cover it on Movieversaries. Joining us today is someone who understands that Little Shop of Horrors isn't about a man and a plant. It's about survival, systems, the quiet horror of wanting just enough. She brings sharp insight, great taste, and unlike Seymour, a strong moral boundary. Welcome, Violet Hammond.
Ooh. Ooh, I was wondering who was going to get that
tag.
I
was like, who is this? I mean, sure, I'll take it. Hi.
Now I'm scared.
You probably should be.
Our next co-host today knows a great deal about any kind of nightmare underneath a melody. He's here to talk Faustian bargains, killer choruses, and why Audrey 2 might be the most honest capitalist in cinema. We're very excited to welcome Bo Nicholson.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Hello. Hi. Glad to be here.
And last but by no means least, we've got our voice in the corner whispering that everything will be fine. He's our resident Audrey 2. Charismatic, persuasive, and absolutely willing to watch the world burn if it makes good radio. We'll feed him and grow him stronger now. Please welcome Ian Buckley.
Feed me. Feed me.
That's a pretty good, good four one. Tops impression there. Well done.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's okay in this climate. but let's go with it.
Yeah, well, true. Good point. It's impersonating a person. Impersonating a person is okay.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it fine. Is. Yeah. It is a very non-specific voice inflection.
It is a plant asking to be fed.
Yeah, it's a plant. It's a plant.
Yeah.
We are all four different plants and yes. herbs across here. No, we've got a full panel today.
Yay! So,
yay!
Yay!
Yay! Yay!
We're all here, guys.
Yay.
Which is always an exciting thing. And we're discussing mm-hmm. possibly the film that I have fallen in love with the most over the last 5 years. I first watched it for Frame to Frame when we did it on there, and I've seen it multiple times since.
Oh, you didn't grow up with this one?
Oh, so, okay.
Not.
Oh,
wow.
All right.
Okay.
Ian, I'm different guessing context. You and I grew up with this.
Yeah,
then.
We
okay.
sure did.
Well, all right. Excellent. Let's dig yeah. into it. Seeing as Bo has remained beautifully silent at this point, what was your relationship coming into to Little Shop of Horrors?
I watched it for the first time 12 hours ago.
Had you heard any of the songs? Were you aware of any of it?
I think I was vaguely aware of Little Shop of Horrors, but that's like that might be it.
That's our second co-host singing.
To
yep,
the point.
There you go.
To the point. We're gonna get all four.
We'll see if we can get
probably,
four.
Probably, yeah. Most likely. Yeah.
to the point that to peel the curtain back, Andy was quite like, "Oh, my intro, is it gonna be an issue?" You know, with like how close it is or whatever. And I listened to it, and I didn't recognize it. So I was just like, oh, you know, like maybe it's got some copyright. I don't really know. And then I listened to it after watching the movie, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's probably a bit of a thing. But to put it out there, we are not making money from this at all. So, you know, we're not trying to do anything nasty. We just have a bit of fun. But yeah, it was...
At what point does something become fair use for parody?
Yes.
At what point does things get fair use? Because I've added my
exactly.
own creativity on top of it.
You did. Exactly. And look, if Titanic is running right now on Broadway and it's basically
right?
a Titanic parody, I think we're okay doing that intro. I think we're good.
I agree.
I think it's fine. Everything yeah. is fine.
Everything yeah, is fine, fine. Always. All the time.
The world's going great, and if seriously, if someone comes after us for that, I'll be like, okay,
really?
Like, seriously? All right, no worries. We'll just have to deal with
we'll
it.
We'll demonetize this one episode.
Yeah.
We'll stop earning the mountains and mountains of cash.
Yeah, mm-hmm. the mountains and mountains.
Definitely.
So if this makes no sense, it's because we have been struck and we've gotten rid of the intro.
True.
The intro.
True. Yep.
But to answer
you're wondering, what intro?
No. Like, what? Don't worry about it.
DM us.
You sure missed out.
We'll,
yes,
what we can
we'll
do.
Send it to you.
Andy sang. It was great.
Yep.
It was great.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't
yeah,
supposed
answer...
to be great. It was supposed to be embodying, you know, the performance of Rick Moranis. But
Andy's right.
Which
it wasn't great. We agree with him completely.
Yeah, it wasn't intimidating at all. Didn't raise the bar at all. So to answer the question, no. Like, it, but yeah, did not grow up with it for sure.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, that's. I didn't grow up with it, but yeah. Anyway, Ian, I'm guessing that you did grow up with it from what you've already said.
Yeah, this is one of those where I just can't remember even watching it for the first time, because for a certain span of my childhood, it was one of those movies that I actually did watch and rewatch. I didn't really do that with a ton of movies. I did it more when I was younger, and this was one of those that I watched many times when I was younger. You know, it would be on in the video store when I'd go to my local video store. Like, I saw this movie a lot before the age of like 13. And then I didn't watch it again until two nights ago. And that was probably the first time in maybe 20 plus years. It had been a long time. I didn't catch this. I don't think I ever owned this on DVD. Like, I don't know why, but this movie just kind of fell off my radar for a while. It was always in the background of like, oh yeah, I love Little Shop, of course, but I hadn't actually sat down and watched it for years and years. And man, I can't tell you what it felt like to like hear all these songs again. And I was just like, oh my God, I remember this. I remember this. And I'm just feeling it in my bones. And I'm like moving around on the couch. And I'm just like, you know, I'm transported back 30 plus years. It's a fun time.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. And I'm assuming, Violet, that you've not only seen this multiple times, I'm guessing you've probably staged it at some point.
I did.
And I've seen it on stage. Yeah.
I haven't.
Oh, yeah. Yes, we did this in my high school. It was after I had graduated, but my mother and I were still doing the costumes. So when we talk about the ending, the two endings, spoiler alert, in a little bit, I will have some, yes. I'll have some things to say about that. Cool. I did also produce it at my theater. So yeah, nice. I have a fair amount of experience with Little Shop. I saw it on Broadway when it made its Broadway debut, even though it was in the revival category because it wasn't going to be classified as a new musical, even though it was, it's because right. It was an off-Broadway show. It was not on Broadway until fairly recently. And it's still running off-Broadway now. An incredibly successful production has been running for years, I think about 6 years right now.
Yeah, how did you manage the plant? How did you manage Audrey II as a...
Well,
it's an entity whilst you're using that puppetry on stage.
You can do different, there's different ways to do it. You can choose to make your own, but the licensing company has a lot of packages of it where if you add to your licensing fee, they will send you, and it's just three plants on stage, depending on how crazy you want to get with it. But it's the plant that sits on a table that someone's under the table and puts their hand up. The first one for girlfriend.
Don't ruin that magic. Don't not.
Sorry. Oh, you don't want me to. You don't want me to tell you that. And then the one that he's holding. Then yeah. I won't ruin that one.
You asked the question, Andy.
Yes.
How was it done?
Yeah. But it works. It works the same in the movie as it does in the show. That is the same. That like it's a, you know, do you want me to tell you or do you want not?
Yeah,
want
let's
to
know? Go. That it seems we're ripping the curtain down.
It's a fake arm in the jacket holding the flower pot, and Rick Moranis's arm is inside the plant. So he is actually operating it when it's the one that he's carrying around, like the one he takes to the radio station. Mm-hmm. That's how that one works. So that's this. Right. That's the second plant. And then in the show, the musical, when you stage it, the third plant is like the big one that there's usually one large puppeteer or two if you need, where they're inside and it's like arms in the top mouth that make it, yeah. You know, and it does not in any way look as good as it does in the movie, but we'll get into how the, you know, the puppetry of this movie. But yeah, it's just basically like, you know. I look like
that
I look like Pac-Man right now. Yeah, it doesn't really work for podcasting, but
yeah, we're doing but like yeah, alligator arms.
It does not in any way look as good as it does in this movie on stage, but it's still a lot of fun.
Now, who here has seen Roger Corman's 1960 original?
Me.
I have.
Yes.
Okay. You know, I thought I might be the only one, and instead, it's most of us. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Not me.
We recorded our episode on Frame to Frame, and I fell in love, and I this is the one film I've always wanted to return to with Sean, because mm-hmm. I don't feel that we did it justice.
Cool.
It's just kind of the one I really want to dig into a little bit more in a way that we didn't in that first watching for me. So I'm pleased to be able to do it on Movieversaries, and I'm very, very thankful for
yay.
The three of you, with all of our differing perspectives, coming for it. But
yes. Now, who here got to watch it in a theater and ask Roger Corman questions about it afterwards?
Oh, shit.
Okay, I needed to win something. So
you, wow.
Yeah.
That's so awesome.
The oft-referenced Avon Theater in Stamford, Connecticut that I used to work at, we did a Q&A event for... with Roger Corman. He came. It was sadly underattended, but that did mean that we got his undivided attention. There was maybe 15 of us, 20 of us. I mean, it was really underattended, unfortunately, but we had a blast, and he just could not have been more generous with his time. And he, you know, we asked him all kinds of stories. It was great. It was really unforgettable. Very experience.
Yeah, that's cool. Awesome.
I love this movie. I had seen that more recently, and that was like 20 years ago than I had seen this until just this week.
I mean, Roger Corman was a film studio unto himself. He was amazing, beautiful godfather of New Hollywood. And I can only imagine the glee and pleasure that you would have had discussing that film with him.
Yeah, it was a blast.
But this version, the musical version, which is celebrating its 40th movieversary.
Disgusting.
Which is mad. God. Adapted from the off-Broadway, as you mentioned, Violet, musical from 1982 with composer Alan Menken, yes, that guy, and writer Howard Ashman, yes, that guy, and directed by the great Frank Oz. You know, he might know a thing or two about puppets. The question I want to ask, I'll go straight to Beau as the person that has seen it most recently for the first time. Does it hold up?
Yes, but... I guess would be my answer. It was very funny. Like I was genuinely caught off guard because from what I could see of like the trailer in that, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be like Rocky Horror vibes, like give or take, like a musical with comedy with just weird and horror. And it was, and then it was just like a lot funnier, I think, and a lot less problematic, I think. So I liked it a lot more. I found myself laughing hysterically. Like, just like the hard crash cut straight into Steve Martin on a motorcycle. And then like that next like 6 minutes, including like in that song Dentist, which is just like...
Dentist. Yeah.
Unreal.
Even that whole song is a twist, so and then another twist, and then another twist. I love Dentist.
And his physical performance of that song is just, it's remarkable. Like, I've just, wow. I need to watch
it. Did it remind you of Meatloaf in Rocky Horror?
Kind of, but I liked that he stuck around a little bit longer in the film. And I think it was a better performance. Like, maybe not vocally for sure, but like, you know, like I just think.
I mean, it's an actual role. I mean, there's, you know, he is integral to the story in a way that that Meatloaf character just isn't.
And I don't know, like, I do have some questions. I have, as I said, I saw it 12 hours ago, right? So I haven't, like, fully explored my thoughts on this. I think there are some questions that can be had in the year 2026 about representation in the film, good or bad. I couldn't help but notice that the only black characters were the Greek chorus and the planet destroying plant. So I'm kind of like in Skid Row, which has like, according to latest data, 40% black population in the real world. You know, I kind of just think, is there like an amber flag there, an orange flag, not a red flag, but like an orange flag? Is there a question about representation that we can talk about? Did it age well in that way? I'm not sure I know the answer, but it did raise questions. So I would say yes, it did age well, but I have some questions.
We can dig into that in a little bit. Let's go in the same order. Let's go to Ian, because, you know, you mentioned having had a long gap. And it coming back to you as you were watching it, did you feel that it still plays well?
Absolutely. I started moving the second the music started. it was in my bones immediately. I went right back to it. So, this movie rocks. It's weird. I hadn't remembered so much of the kind of thorny details of it. I didn't remember how bad the Steve Martin character was. I had forgotten. I just remembered like, oh, he's like a sadistic dentist. I had forgotten the like domestic violence angle, like straight up. I just did not remember that part of the story, and was like, oh, they are very explicit about this. This is messed up. And I had remembered that Bill Murray had a scene that was funny. I missed the like sexual nature of the masochism. Like that as a kid just flew right over my head. I thought it was just, oh, it's Bill Murray being silly. I love him in Ghostbusters. Like I did not get the like sadomasochism thing that was going on, like on all those levels. Very, very funny, even funnier as an adult. Like I loved that sequence. And you know, that's the role that, you know, Beau. So in the 1960 Little Shop of Horrors, like Jack Nicholson makes his film debut as the Bill patient. Murray character.
My Uncle Jack. Yeah. That's
yes.
Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah.
So like so much about this movie that I had forgotten that I was interested to rediscover, but also so much that I remembered that I was so excited to hear again and watch again. And I had forgotten how outstanding the Audrey effect is. Mm-hmm. The puppetry work is astonishingly good. It holds up to an outrageous degree. An outrageous degree. I was blown away. I was watching it and thinking, like, there's no CGI here, right? Like, it's just so good.
I had the same thought. Yeah. It was like, no. Then I saw, like, the visual effects at the very end of the film, and I was like, no, it was definitely a puppet. Yeah.
Yeah.
because the visual effects were not good, but the puppetry was, elite. Yeah.
I mean, they were of their time. Violet. Yes. Do you think it still holds up? Would you introduce this to somebody that hadn't watched it at a relatively young age now?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's so much fun. It's another thing that you and I love. It's so camp. It's so silly.
Me?
You?
Very silly.
What?
Yeah.
We've all heard the intro.
Me too. I love that shit.
Yeah. It's so camp. It's so silly. It's just the kind of thing that you would, I mean, and it works for the stage show too. And again, like the stage show and the movie are very different. And as far as like, I have not seen the movie in a while, but I like remember the stage show very well. And all of the things that really surprised me in the movie are the things that aren't in the stage show, like all the celebrity cameos, basically. Like you don't see Seymour go to the radio station in the show. It's just like a pre-recorded scene change thing. Mm. Like you just hear him, they're in the flower shop listening to him on the radio while the scene is changing. But this, it becomes an entire John Candy cameo. And it's hysterical.
He's great. Like, just
it's so funny.
A great scene.
Yes.
Before rewatching this, I watched the recent John Candy documentary. Only because, I mean, I watched the Chevy Chase one and realized he's a dick. So,
oh, he is. Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't that made me realize it, but, you know, it really
confirmed it.
Further
and then
does nothing to dispel the rumors about him being a dick.
Yeah, he will not beat the allegations. No.
No. But then when I wanted some happiness, so I watched the John Candy one, and everyone loved John Candy.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And he's so good in this. It's one of those scenes that if there wasn't a plethora of scenes of performances that people would run away in other movies with, he would run away with this movie, but he's amongst great. So when I sort of first watched it back when we did Friends Frame, I realized almost immediately I could watch this with my daughter. So I waited a little bit longer because when we did it she was very young, and we watched this several times, and when I said I was doing it for this, then the songs came back out and both children started singing them. And it is exactly the right level of sort of scrungy horror that works for my two kids, at least.
Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned Beau having some of the butts. Mm-hmm. Let's dig into it, because a Greek chorus is something that Alan Menken brought back when he did the music for Hercules.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of, retrospectively, there's a lot of Hercules that came from Little Shop of Horrors in the sort of makeup of the way the Greek chorus sounds for me. It might just be me
I would agree with you. Yeah.
And to have that gospel-inflected Greek chorus, I mean, I can understand where you're coming from in terms of representation, but I think those characters specifically had to be African-American.
So I guess where I sort of had questions was very similarly, if you guys remember when La La Land came out 10 years ago and there was this whole conversation about like, oh cool, like we're using jazz to tell a story about very white people. And I love that movie, but I can see that criticism, you know. And I just think early 1960s, pre-civil rights, Skid Row, We're alluding to conversations. Some of the songs explicitly talk about things like poverty and hopheads and all that sort of stuff. And the only black characters are the chorus and Audrey too. I've got no problem with the Greek chorus being black women with gospel style vocals. In fact, I loved a lot of their input. I guess what I'm talking about is, like, are we using the flavor of blackness to tell a story about white people with a black villain? Like, is that weird? Or is that maybe a bit dicey? Maybe something that wouldn't happen in 2026. You know what I mean? So I guess that's where I kind of landed on that.
Do you think it would be slightly different if one of the main principles was of a different ethnic background?
Yeah, probably.
Like that would kind of undo...
Not necessarily
it's
black, even
issue with
just
the,
like,
casting as
Asian or something.
The...
Or... Yeah, I think so. Because as it stands and this might be true in the 1960s, I'm not sure, but it's just like a few black people, and they're like passed out on the street. They're singing, and by the way, the Greek chorus often singing with the villain. By the way, like come in or whatever they're saying, come here, like all that sort of stuff. So the only black characters are that. There's no Hispanics, there's no, like, Asian people, which there is a huge population of in Skid Row now. So, yeah, I don't know. I think just different choices would have been made in 2026. So when we talk about how it aged, that's just a little question that I have. But it sounds like it didn't bump the rest of you, so.
Yeah, I mean, I also don't know, what was the racial makeup of that part of Manhattan in the 50s. I mean, we're well south of Harlem. Like, that is where, that's the part of town that is, I think, traditionally associated with, like, black Americans in New York City in that era. Like, the Bowery is essentially where this takes place. And, like, I don't know what the racial makeup was in the 50s. It might have been many more European immigrants, as we see here. Like, this could be accurate representation. I just don't know.
Am I way off base? Isn't it L.A.? Is Skid Row LA?
No, this is Manhattan.
No, this is downtown Manhattan.
This is downtown Manhattan.
That is interesting. Okay.
Yeah. That's what it's supposed to. I mean, you know, Mushnick owns the flower shop. He speaks Yiddish. It's a very Lower East Side Manhattan kind of situation. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, this is interesting.
I think in this era, we're probably looking at, I'm just guessing, more Eastern European immigrants than we are other, you know.
Well, if you type in Skid Row into any search engine, it comes up as a band or LA.
Yes. It comes up as Sebastian Bach
So Skid Row is really more of a concept here I don't really know whether it's a little different in other cultures, other countries, but like the it's more of a concept here of this is a poor neighborhood, like generically a poor neighborhood. But, you know, in the movie, you see an elevated train, which used to exist in that part of town in that era, doesn't anymore. Mm-hmm. And you see, like, the Empire State Building in the background as it looks uptown. You see uptown in the background. This is downtown, kind of Lower East Side.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, right. Okay, because, like, I'm now looking up other disambiguations of it, and it's like, they have one in Vancouver. They have one in San Fran. They have one in Portland, Oregon, to be clear, not Portland, Maine.
To be clear, not Portland.
Different place, as we learned.
And the one that comes up automatically on Google is Los Angeles. So this is an example of Australia not knowing the geography. I don't know.
There's also, you know, you mentioned if it was done in 2026, would it be done differently? And there was a remake planned with Taron Egerton, Scarlett Johansson playing Seymour and Audrey, with Billy Porter voicing Audrey too. Billy Porter.
Huh.
Yes.
So once again, there would be two Caucasian.
Dynamic. Yep. And Chris Evans was going to be the dentist, and you better believe I wanted to see that. So
yeah, I still want to see that. Whether he'd have a beard or not. Anyway, different thing.
He wouldn't have a beard, but I hope he'd be tap dancing at some point.
Would he still be Elvis, do you reckon, essentially? you know, pumping up the chair, like, you know, with that Elvis movement.
I mean, I'd forgotten how Elvis coded he was, mm-hmm, too.
Mm-hmm. Like a couple of years after he died in 78, right, Andy? So it was 37. So the musical was only like 4 or 5 years after he died.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that Andrew Lloyd Webber has done a hell of a lot, in that he's pretty much always got some form of Elvis coded character.
Yeah, like he's the Pharaoh in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Like, there's always an Elvis somewhere.
Yeah. So when you're, I guess, parodying the time period that they are in Little Shop of Horrors, you've got a lot of 60s, you've got a lot of Motown. So then to sprinkle in Elvis kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But it goes back to the age-old question of, is it inspiration or is it appropriation? Because, you know, you've got Menken and Ashman who were responsible for the music that, you know, they were two white guys. So, again, are they inspired by? They obviously love and revere the music that they're taking inspiration from.
Mm-hmm.
But at what point are we appropriating? So let's look at, I guess, the wider themes of the film. That's something that we tend to delve into. You look at, you've got capitalism, you've got selling out, you've got monetizing spectacle, you've got viral culture to a degree. Mm-hmm. Like, Violet, how do you feel thematically this still works? Because I think we're all in a broad agreement it still works.
Yeah.
So thematically, on what levels, why do you think that still works?
I think it still works because it shows you how easy it is to make that leap to just sacrifice everything, all your morals, like everything that you think you hold dear to what makes you a good person, and then just like throw that all in the mouth of a plant to hope to get some money and to get the girl. Like, it's just like, you know, the rampant consumerism will eat you alive.
Feed me.
Feed me. So, well, that hasn't changed. Blood.
The system was blood.
The more you put in, the bigger it grows. Allegedly. The harder it is to feed it. Yeah. Like, it's never going to be satisfied.
Yeah. I mean, that's extremely bow-coded. This kind of capitalism with teeth.
Yep.
Yeah, as he leans forward.
It's also interesting. You know, I had forgotten. They do, I think, have this in the 1960 version too, but just the idea of, you know, this plant kind of ensorcelling you into doing things you otherwise wouldn't do. I mean, there's a suggestion of, you know, mind control and warping perceptions, and people do. I mean, it's a camp movie. People are going to pop up and act in kind of weird, unnaturalistic ways anyway, but there's a couple of performances where people, like that first guy who comes in and asks about the plant, it's having some sort of effect on him. That guy's a weirdo. His performance is very, very funny.
Yeah.
Right. That's the Christopher Guest.
Christopher Guest. Yes.
It's very, very funny. It's very, very odd. And it's suggestive of, you know, this thing is having a warping effect on the minds of anyone who comes into its orbit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which the system does.
Oh, absolutely.
That's the thing. Yeah.
I think the tone does a lot of the heavy lifting to make it palatable for us. But when you dig down underneath to what the film and the songs, the show is actually saying, it's very dark.
Oh,
you mentioned, Violet, the two endings.
Yes.
But which ending did you watch, by the way?
Apparently the theatrical. So I saw a happy ending.
Not
that kind of happy ending.
That's the one that everyone grew up with.
Yes.
Yeah. And honestly, so about half, I was being a bit annoying, actually, because Alex is very familiar with the film. Yeah, I know, right?
Oh, okay.
And her mum, like Violet and her mum, was involved in stage musicals and things like that back in their hometown. So she was pretty familiar with it. And I'm doing the annoying thing where I'm like, so when does Steve Martin get eaten by this thing? Because it's super obvious pretty early doors that this thing is going to feed on humans, right? And therefore, Steve Martin is going to be like first cab off the rank. And then it got to the point where I was like, when does it eat Audrey? Because it was setting it up so much for that, right? And then, of course, half eaten, she gets spat out. She has the most unrealistic reaction of all time, which is like, of course I forgive you, like moments after being inside the mouth of a plant, but whatever. And honestly, I found it a little bit unsatisfying because I was like, no, this has been building towards Audrey being eaten and then maybe also the system destroying everything in its path, right? That's what it was building towards. So I was really hoping for that straight up bitter, tragic ending, you know? And I think the movie is not as good for not having it. So I haven't seen the director's cut where it has been switched back and everything. I heard they had terrible test scores at the time. And apparently the play has the sad ending.
The play, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, they filmed it in like an insane film version of it. But in
they
the
spent
play.
A hell of a lot of money on that.
Yeah, they spent a lot of money on it. But
it's outrageous. It becomes a kaiju movie in the last 10 minutes. Legitimately, like it is these giant
the plants stomping through cities and
streets.
It's crazy.
I agree with you, though. That's clearly the original intention. Because
that is what's happening. Yes.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, Audrey is pulled from the plant, but she dies in his arms. And one of her last things is like, she says like, you know, the plant said the strangest thing, you know, said that like Mr. Mushnick and I can't remember the dentist's name were already in there.
Orin, and
he comes clean as she dies. And then that leads him to.
She asks him to.
Oh no, you're right. You're right. She asks him to feed her
the
plant. And he does. And it's this very kind of like sweet, like he gently lays her into the mouth. She gently sort of slides in. He like touches her hand as it goes by.
That's green is playing because she's going somewhere that's green. Yeah.
Yes. It's, yes.
It's
and
crazy.
Then he goes to jump off the roof and. Yeah. A salesman approaches and says, hey, but another one of those, hey, by the way, I'm a character now in this movie. The guy approaches and said, hey, I've taken these clippings here. Look, I've made another little Audrey too. And you see that, you know, that realization then dawn on Seymour that, oh God, this is the plan, global takeover. And he goes and confronts Audrey and they have a fight and then Audrey eats Seymour and then the plants go on a rampage and essentially the world ends.
Correct.
They destroy
they
everything.
Take over the world
now.
Yes,
my creative hot take with the ending now, they completely reintegrate it, recolored and graded it is indistinguishable. You can't tell. It is a complete looking and feeling movie with that ending reintegrated. However, I think there are probably a bunch of people who were involved in recovering this legendary lost ending who are like, we're not cutting a second from this because it's a big deal and we just discovered this, because there are maybe like 10 or 12 very samey shots of like bricks exploding out with Audrey bursting through, like Audrey's burst through maybe like 10 or 12, I'm not exaggerating, facades, different facades. And it's like, it's all one note. It's very, personally, I think that realistically there would have been some cut out of there, but it is a more cohesive story. Like everything that you're saying in terms of how they seem to be setting things up is how it was set up. That is how the movie originally ends.
Mm-hmm. So this show ends, and Don't Feed the Plants is a banger, a certified banger.
And then there's a final song.
Yeah.
Which is
Don't
great.
Feed the Plants is amazing.
Which Bo hasn't heard.
No.
I haven't heard. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I encourage your next viewing, do the director's cut.
Yes.
You can just grab it on YouTube. Just watch.
Yeah, or just watch YouTube. The last 20 minutes is different, but that's it. Yeah.
And
everything
else
is the same.
You see the Statue of Liberty, so
yes,
it would have.
Audrey 2 is on top of the Statue of Liberty. Yes.
That's the final. That's the final shot. Is Audrey mounting the Statue of Liberty with the end? !
Yep. It's great.
Yeah,
not
it's full blown.
Not the one in LA,
the
by the way. Not the Statue of Liberty that's out in LA.
Stop it.
No. It's the one in New York.
Yeah, leave me alone. Me and my geography.
I'm guessing that the three of us that have seen the more robust bleak ending, shall we say, the more downbeat, bleak ending, we prefer that, right? That should be the definitive version.
It should. I mean, yeah, it's not happy, but it's what...
It's the one that has the most creative integrity, let's say.
Yeah.
And I think that my little nitpicks about the actual footage that was recovered and reintegrated aside, it makes sense to Beau's point about, like, hey, this seems to be what they were building towards, and then they clearly got some bad test audience responses and made a hard left shift and reshot the ending. John Belushi gets a little cameo, and then they have this happy ending at the end, and like, it's fine. Like, it's and it's the one I grew up with, right? Like, I fell in love with this movie watching this ending. I've seen that ending so many more times. Like, in my mind, when I think of how does Little Shop of Horrors end, that's the ending that comes to my mind. But yeah, if I'm looking at it objectively, like, this makes sense. This is a better movie. Yeah.
And no one was happy about it. Frank Oz wasn't happy about it. Howard Ashman wasn't happy about it.
Yeah, none of them were happy about it.
None of them wanted to do this. However, they weren't going to release the movie unless they changed the ending, because the test audiences hated it.
And Beau, when you see how much money they spent on this ending, that in and of itself
is $2 million, wasn't it?
Like,
yeah,
it was like $5 million. There was a whole Manhattan miniature.
It is an enormous sequence that they just cut out.
It's crazy. And Frank Oz actually had like a really good point about why the audiences hated it so much. He said like they were watching the movie and they were cheering after all the songs and they loved everything. And then Audrey died and Seymour died. He says, and it was like a refrigerator in there. Like the whole thing chilled. It cooled down. Everybody hated it. The cards were terrible. And he realized that this show could be a hit off Broadway and everyone could love it because the actors still come out for a curtain call. The audience gets to see the actors come back. Like, they're alive. It's okay. Wasn't that
you
a fun show?
Give them the moment in front of everyone.
Yeah. Wasn't that a fun show? But in a movie, they're dead. They're gone. And the audience didn't forgive them for killing them. Also in the show, like, because... those of you who saw the Roger Corman will know their faces are in the flowers at the end. They sing in the finale on stage.
Yes.
Because when Audrey 2's blooms open, Beau, the faces of the people he ate are in there. So they're singing Don't Feed the Plants at the end. It sounds insane, but it's so good.
It sounds like I'm missing a lot.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. You're missing 20 minutes. We touched on there being an additional song.
Yes.
Let's dig into the songs, because I am an unapologetic Howard Ashman lover. I think that, you know, there's some things that you can look at in his work that could be viewed as cultural appropriation. You look at things like Aladdin, you look at Sebastian in The Little Mermaid, but he is the soundtrack to my childhood, right?
Yes.
Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin were three of the great movies that I had growing up. And Little Shop of Horrors, being him alongside the wonderful Alan Menken, who, once again, you look through some of the work that he's done, he's, again, everything that Disney has done that has been great can be fed back to those two men.
Yes.
From 1989 onwards.
Correct.
And
yeah, it's an unbelievable run.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is the two of them kind of kickstarting that working relationship.
Yep.
So, Ian, generally speaking, what would be the song that you would reach for? What would be the one that you go to and go, oh, this is a really, really good song?
There's
so many. That's why I want to pick one.
Mm. Yeah, that is tough. I think it's largely due to how sticky the performance is in my mind, but Dentist is one of those that's like, that entire sequence just feels so classic to me. I, you know, that out of anything is probably the one that I would pick, but there are some musical moments that I really like. I love when Audrey is, like, supper time, when Audrey is confronted by the plant at the end, and the music is very, like, groovy. And yes, yeah. I can't mimic it, but it's like when that hits in the soundtrack.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, oh, there'll be more. Don't worry.
In the soundtrack, I'm really keyed up. I really like that musical moment. So those are the two that stick out to me. But everything. I mean, like I said, right as soon as the music started, I started dancing on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that too. Having spent time on couches or even in ice cream shops with you, if there's music, there's a groove. The shoulders start going.
If the shoulders are going, then Ian's having a great time.
Mm-hmm.
Violet, I'd imagine, heard these songs hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times.
Many, many times, yes.
What do you think would be the one that kind of best encapsulates where Mencken and Ashman were at this point?
Well, I hate to echo Dentist, but I think that Dentist is Howard Ashman's probably best and most clever lyric, top to bottom. The fact that he worked Marquis de Sade into an off-Broadway musical about a plant that eats people is insane. The fact that they literally are singing Who Wants Their Teeth Done by the Marquis de Sade, that's insane. It's maybe my favorite lyric in the entire show. It's so good. As far as like the urchin songs, I think I'm kind of sad that the Meek Shall Inherit is kind of truncated in this, because that song is such a bop. It's so good. I love the Meek Shall Inherit.
And then Bo, as a first timer, was there any one that sort of stood out to you?
As I said, Dentist was definitely that was the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the moment. I will then give a shout out to Skid Row, actually, in parentheses, Downtown, especially the way that Beatrice Redding starts that song. Is like, as she's walking in like trench coat style down an alleyway. And then that voice behind that, I was just like, ooh, like immediately grabbing my attention. That's pretty early in the movie. Mm-hmm. And it does set up those themes about poverty and all that sort of stuff really well, which was actually the moment of the film that it really hooked me, because then I'm like, oh, we're going to start talking about some real shit. Okay, cool. In for that. And then I also enjoyed Dadu, but I think that's just mostly because I recognized it so much from your intro.
Excellent. Yeah, that was the wrong way around to have heard those things.
Like, I just had familiarity with it, so I was like, oh, this is, yeah. Like, and then I was like processing mid-movie, just like, being like,
oh, hold on.
Are we in trouble? Like,
yeah, he's properly just ripped that off.
But yeah, the songs widely are good. Yeah, broadly speaking, very good.
I mean, that's not a controversial take, I don't think. I'm going to plump for Suddenly Seymour.
Nice.
Because that is the... I mean, you've got the I Want song, you've got the part of your world in Somewhere That's Green.
Yep.
But Suddenly Seymour kind of convinces you that the movie's not a tragedy. And then it suddenly all becomes a tragedy.
If you watch the right version, it is. Otherwise, Suddenly Seymour comes off very, very bad, because they kind of reprise it after her salvation. Just kind of like this little moment. And it's just like, to me, the version that I saw weakened that song.
Yes.
I can see that.
Yes. No, I can see it. And that's not where it's supposed to be. In the original, I'm sorry, I keep talking about the stage show, guys, but this is what they filmed too. So if you go back and watch the original thing. So like when Seymour decides, like, this is it, I've had enough, will you marry me? We'll leave. And his plan is to just leave and the plant will starve to death. So if he leaves and the plant can't eat, Audrey 2 will starve to death. So that's where the Suddenly Seymour reprise comes in, when he asks Audrey to marry him. Marry me and we'll leave tonight. And of course, in like true, sad fashion, that's when Audrey 2 learns how to pick up the phone, calls Audrey, has her come over to the shop and eats her right when they're about to make their escape. because this is why Howard Ashman didn't want to change the ending. So he's like, Seymour can't get away with everything that he did. That's an incredibly slippery moral slope that we watch this guy.
Agree.
Yes, that we watch this guy like cut up people and push people into the mouths of this plant and then be like, but now I'm going to go get my American dream house with my pretty wife and I got away with
small
it.
Small picket fence. Yeah.
Yeah.
With permission, Andy, can I jump in with my favorite fact? Because I think it's relevant.
Sure.
So it's not actually about the movie, this fact, but it helped me with the movie, if you will, because I don't know much about Rick Moranis. Like, that was kind of like, what I knew about Rick Moranis was that he was like a big deal in the 80s, especially in the comedy scene, right? Mm-hmm. And early 90s. And then he just like disappeared. And I was mm-hmm. like, what happened with Rick Moranis? So I looked up, you know, did a little bit of research before watching the movie. And this is when I learned for the first time that his wife died of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, some sort of cancer in 1991. She was 34. He was 38. They had a couple of kids. And he tried to keep doing the acting thing. He was in the Flintstones a few years later and all that sort of thing, right? And then he just realized this is untenable. I couldn't keep being a good dad and a movie star. And he just gave up film in 1997. Yeah. And for it just, like, you know, apart from a couple of voice acting roles that were a bit less intensive on his time, so he could be like a good dad for these kids. And I'm telling Alex this story, and we're both just sitting there being like, isn't it nice to hear a nice story about a Hollywood type, you know? Like, he seemed like an actual genuinely good dude. And I've got to tell you, it did a lot of heavy lifting when it came to like forgiving Seymour's actions.
Yes.
like I was along for a lot longer in this movie, and even slightly the happy ending, because I was just like, yeah, but it's Rick Moranis. Like, he seems like a really nice guy.
Yeah. Right. That was the other thing that made this movie such a fixture for me, at least, was Rick Moranis was huge for me when I was a kid. I loved this for that, too. This was like an iconic Rick Moranis performance for me.
Well, yeah. I loved Rick Moranis growing up, but I to this day still don't love Ghostbusters. So, you know, I had Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, I had the Flintstones. Later on, I had Spaceballs.
Spaceballs, yeah.
Spaceballs 2 was one of those for me when I was a kid.
Yeah, we will definitely be covering that when we are able to. However, Rick Moranis was such a great screen presence. And, you know, there was, I don't know if you guys remember, there was the, he was attacked in New York.
Yes.
In like 2020. And there was footage that went online for it, and they caught the alleged perpetrator. And you just sort of go, what did Rick Moranis ever do?
Right, like, right. He's
that guy. He's like,
what did Rick do
great.
To you?
Yeah.
Who was a problem with Rick Moranis?
Of all the people to have a go at, that's not the guy.
Seriously.
No.
But jumping back to Suddenly Seymour, just sort of very quickly, because I want to elevate that song for me. It's the movie at its most sincere. It's the movie at its most positive. I mean, taking out the idealized ending.
Mm.
I love Some With It's Green because the film doesn't sneer at Audrey's ambition. Her ambition being to want something normal. She wants a house and a routine, and she wants the nuclear family. Her dream is small. And then suddenly Seymour makes these feelings extremely big, and that it happens within the music. And it's
and
the
her
film.
Voice. She finds her voice mid-song.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love both the beauty of that song, but then similarly the cruelty in letting it arrive just for it to then be taken away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where Menken and Ashman really subvert a lot of the sort of kitsch 50s sci-fi that they were probably taking off of in the first instance.
So I
love that song. I love almost all of the songs. It's one of those no skip playlists for me. I just wanted to shout out Menken and Ashman.
Good shout. And I think it would play very differently. As I said, my ending somewhat dulls it a bit. The Oscar nomination for Best Original Song went to Mean Green Mother from Outer Space. Mm-hmm. That to me is an odd, like, and this is like the controversial take time. We're in the middle of Oscars season. Golden is going to win Best Original Song from K-pop Demon Hunters. I think it's a bad song. Strap yourself in. It's that time again for a wildly hyperbolic take. I think we do. I think Golden's a bad song. I think it's like an aggressively bad song.
You're having to go at Golden.
Golden, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Golden's great. What's wrong with you?
No, I think it's a bad song.
I thought that's why you played the drop.
Yeah.
And I thought he was having to go at Mean Green Mother. I was like, okay,
he's loading that up.
It's in the chamber. I'm not going to say Mean Green Mother is a bad song, but I would say it's an odd choice to put forward as like the nominee, like the for your consideration. Like,
it's the only one they could
happen.
It's the only one they could. It was the song that was written for the movie.
Oh, thank you for that context.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for that context.
It's the only one they could. Everything else was on the stage. So it was the one original song written for the movie.
Okay.
And this is where my fact is. Can I jump in with my fact? I'm sure you guys know this already. Yeah, okay. So it's the first Oscar-nominated song to contain profanity in the lyrics and was the first to be sung by the villain.
The first ever?
I didn't know.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was the first Oscar-nominated song to have profanity and to be the villain song.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Like, a bit of Oscars history. Thank you.
A little Oscar trivia.
I might use that in future episodes. It didn't win. It got nominated for that and visual effects. And again, that's a funny nomination to me because, like, surely the puppet is more production design and visual effects were poor at the end of the positive ending.
I can kind of explain that for you. If it helps. Okay. And I think you were about to explain it too. So if you want to tag team this
take away.
Yeah, we can do it. So Frank Oz, of course, as we know, master genius with puppets.
He had a really
big team on this one too, though. So how they ended up being able to get those mouth movements look so accurate is because they were doing it at an incredibly slow speed. And Rick Moranis was acting and speaking in slow motion as well. So when they were able to speed up the film to the regular pace of the music and the dialogue, it looked natural. But they were filming and puppeteering in slow motion. And even Jim Henson was like, the lip sync on the puppet is insane. Like, there's, like, I don't
it
know.
It looks so
it
good.
It looks so real.
It looks amazing.
And that's, yes. And that is a practical puppeteering effect filmed in slow motion.
Yeah. Wow. So in my mind, when I think of visual effects, I think of maybe this is like modern brain rot, but I think of like Avatar or like digitally superimposing a landscape behind some characters or whatever. Like West Side Story, the Steven Spielberg one, that was like part set, mostly digital reimagining. So that gets a visual effects nomination at the Oscars. So I was just like, I'm using that part of the brain, being like, where are the visual effects? Oh, right at the end of the movie, and they're bad? Okay. cool. At the weakest part of the film? All right. Awesome. Like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for that explanation. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you'll actually look at the visual effect of the director's original intended ending and be like, not bad.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it does. Okay. It looks really good. It's insane.
But especially for 86. It looks
It looks really good for 86.
I'm keen to watch this.
Yeah, it's fun.
Well, this is like you've got when we're looking at films from 40 odd years ago, then you've got to contextualize it, right? It was up against Aliens and Poltergeist 2.
Right.
I can't bring Poltergeist 2 to mind, oddly
Tron
enough.
A little bit earlier.
Never seen it.
Yeah.
Poltergeist 2?
No. I've not seen
Poltergeist 2. It's not as good as the first one, but it's still scary.
Shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, the year before this, Return to Oz was nominated, which, you know, wasn't great.
But talk about
a couple of years after we had Who Framed Roger Rabbit. and then The Abyss, and then that's when CGI began to really take off. So when you're looking at the mastery of the puppets, I think that it's one of the key reasons this film holds up is because it's practical. Like we had a conversation on Frame to Frame literally a few days ago as we're recording this about Metropolis, how effects stand up because they're physical, because they're tactile. And that's where I think that even to a young audience now, they can just get on board with this, with puppetry, because
right,
it's physical.
Yeah,
it's actually there.
Mm-hmm.
Seems we're doing facts. Ian, what's your fact for your fun fact for Little Shop of Horrors?
God, I don't know if I have a separate one besides the ones that you guys have already mentioned. We've just been talking about so many things I love about the movie. I don't have a specific one anymore.
I mean, the main one, I guess, is to do with the ending being completely
shot. I mean, I really wanted us to talk about that, and I feel like we've done that now.
Yeah. At
length. And the puppetry.
Puppetry I definitely wanted to shout out. I was not clear on, like, I thought, obviously they constructed a set for this. I was really curious about the like background elements. You know, you see the elevated train and you see mm-hmm. what I think are actual people. What I was a little unclear on watching this on, you know, even on the TV, is whether those were actual people being photographed in the background, whether that was like a photographic plate that was being projected back there, or whether that was like animated in some way. Like, I was like, this is less a fact and more a question that I don't have the answer to. Is I was curious. I noticed the sort of elevated subway in the back and the people, mm-hmm. you know, getting on and off on that platform. And I just was another one of those like little visual details of this movie that I appreciated and wanted to know more about.
I don't have an answer for you.
No, I know.
I wish I did.
Nobody does. No, I mean, somebody in the world does. Nobody here does. Yes. There really was no point in me bringing it up, but I needed something to say.
I mean, I don't know if they were the real people walking around or if they projected it, but they did build the whole set inside the 007 set. So
the set's
fantastic. The train was run. Yeah, I was like, oh my God, they spent a lot of money on this movie.
Yeah.
Yes. That brings me, I think, to my fact, which is the only person that reprised their role from the theatrical production being Ellen Green.
Yes, and, Doctor.
Well, when I first read that, I thought, seriously?
Like,
really? Because, you know, she, for the most part, she's not a great singer, and her voice is actually quite annoying for a lot of it. But then in Suddenly Seymour, you suddenly go, oh, this woman can sing. Like, so why has she been talking in that really annoying like, why has that been a thing?
It's a character choice.
It's a choice, yeah.
Yeah.
And
I mean, like, it's comedic, I think, is why she's doing it, because it's a funny voice. She's playing a funny character. That was, I mean, I
very
find
Lena
it
Lamont.
Funny as opposed to grating. I think some people might be like, this is annoying. This is a voice I don't like. For me, I just think it's funny.
Yeah.
Well, I've grown into seeing the humor, but then first time I was like, okay,
what is this?
Fine. Sure.
Yeah.
I liked the finding the voice. Like, and I could see it building. I was just like, okay, is this person's voice? Am I about to tease somebody for having just a voice? You know, Joey Lauren Adams or like Fran Drescher or whatever, like, you know, like these kind of people that have these unusual voices. No, it's not her voice at all. It's a choice. And the way that it builds into her finally feeling free enough to sing properly and suddenly Seymour is a trope that I like, the way they use that. So I actually really appreciate that. In fact, I was still kind of like, yeah, but is her speaking voice like this still? So I went and found an interview of her and the original off-Broadway Seymour on The Tonight Show. And it was funny because in the description, it said interview with Ellen Green and whatever his name was, but his name was struck out because she just didn't shut up. like 4 minutes. It was just her talking the whole time and like a million miles an hour, just like going for it. And so look it up if anyone wants to, for the Tonight Show in like 1983.
We'll link it in the show notes.
And she, her voice is just actually more annoying because she just talks too fast, but it's very different to the movie.
So that kind of brings us to any shortcomings. I mean, Bo, you mentioned the sort of reluctance with the racial politics, which is absolutely fair. But our resident Americans, Ian and Violet, Violet, any shortcomings?
The only thing that I thought we were going to talk about was the Chinese market when he finds Audrey too. I was like,
Oh yeah.
That, I was like, this is the one. I was like,
so that was a bum note. Yeah.
When the introduction, I was unsure whether to take that one out because it's not good. And then it was a question of, well, if I'm keeping it in, then do I reference it in the same way that they do in the original? And I just did not. Yep. I was not touching that one.
Just leave that one.
I don't want China angry at me as well as the copyright. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, again, as in so many ways with this movie, is that on stage, he's just telling the story of how he found the plant, and the urchins are like singing and, you know, doing their choreo in the background. You never see any of that stereotypical stuff that they showed us on the screen. So that's a very 80s thing.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching that scene came up, and I was just like, I mean, at least they didn't cast a white guy.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're pointing to things that we're thankful for in that brief sequence, it's that. But yeah, it was a little, whatever, you know. It's not ideal.
No. But any shortcomings then, Ian? Anything that drags the movie back?
No, not really. I mean, I had, like I said, it had been so long since I'd watched it. I'd forgot so many smaller details, but... Yeah, I think for the most part, it really does. Certainly visually, it's great. The Audrey puppet is phenomenal. I think that Rick Moranis' performance is excellent and iconic. And I think that, you know, the music is a great time. And I think that it's also a story told, yes, through this comedic musical lens, but also has themes that people recognize and resonate with, and so it's lingered in pop culture still. I think it's still relevant.
In which case, that brings me to Bo's favorite question. Bowden, is this capital G great?
No, not capital G great.
Are we going with lowercase g?
I'm happy to call it good.
Capital G good.
Capital G good.
How about G get out?
Stop asking Dwarf. Me.
It's over there.
It's nowhere near as good as Get Out. I don't think it's capital G great. No, I don't. I think it's good. I had a good time with it. I think Steve Martin hugely elevates the movie for me when he's in it. I think John Candy's
He's only in it for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
They're great.
It just pumps it. I think that, as we've said, the puppeteering is elite. The songs are great for the most part. Like, I don't have many issues. I just have questions and then a really bad ending. I think if I saw the ending you guys are talking about, I could be having a very different reaction. Where I sit right now, I'm at like 3.5 stars. So that's like good. Yeah, it's a good movie.
Okay.
So, Andy, I have a question for you, Andy, though. Like, I know how you feel about Bill Murray. Does his scene, like, really bother you? Or can you just get past it because Steve Martin is chewing the scenery?
So, Steve Martin is kind of taking the scene away from him. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, you when he came up earlier, there's that whole undertone of weird sexual notions from Bill Murray's character, and that's in keeping. That's Bill Murray. Like, that's what he did in Ghostbusters, and that's part of what I really get annoyed about with him is that not everything has to be about that.
Yes.
But there's so little of him that you can kind of brush that away. I'd have preferred Jack Nicholson. Yeah. And, you know, that's saying something because, as we know, Jack Nicholson's probably not the nicest guy in real life.
Also an Oscar winner by this point, too. So it's a very... that's a hell of a cameo.
That's true. But yeah, so it's not my favorite scene of the movie, but because it's a scene. You can there's so much about the film that I love that it doesn't bother me that much.
It didn't bother me at all. I had forgotten how funny I found that scene and still find it. I'm just very tickled by the sadists not being able to derive any pleasure out of torturing somebody.
They're enjoying the table turning too much.
Yeah, the table turning is very effective for me. And I would disagree. I think Bill Murray, Steve Martin steals the scenes, when he appears first in the movie. And then I think Bill Murray comes right in and just picks his fucking pocket in this one scene for this one scene. And then, back to the Steve Martin show. But yeah, I was definitely here for the Bill Murray cameo. But I think Jack Nicholson would have done a great job because he already did once.
He already did. Yeah.
I second that take from Ian, though. I feel that Bill Murray took the air out of Steve Martin's balloon as a character. And I think somewhat in the scene as well. Definitely picked his pocket is a good way to put it. And then it becomes, then that asphyxiation scene.
Oh, my God.
what the hell? This movie is crazy.
I've forgotten that gas mask contraption that he has. Jesus Christ.
Yes.
And the eyes. Freak. The eyes where he's just laughing hysterically. And just far out, man. This is wired.
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming that the rest of us think that it's capital G great. Violet, Ian, are we on board with that?
I'm on board with that.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to split hairs, maybe you could call it a very good movie with which I have a capital G great time.
I mean, that's certainly splitting hairs. I'm going all in on great.
Like I said, if you want to split hairs, that's how I would split them.
So we've covered two 1986 movies this year. One of them, Stand By Me, and the other one's Little Shop of Horrors. Now, I don't think I expected a 3-1 vote, not capital G great, for Stand By Me, and a 3-1 vote is capital G great for this movie. Just going into it, into this year, I did not expect that at all.
I'll say for me, it has a lot to do with the place that this movie holds in my life. Like we talked about Stand By Me, I didn't see that movie until 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And this, I watched a lot, a lot as a kid. And so it's just more intertwined in my identity. So these songs are just more in my bones than anything about Stand By Me, as much as I appreciate elements of that movie. So for me, this is always going to have the edge.
I think this is more fun. It's unabashedly far more fun because it's supposed to be, it has the backbone of making an Ashman for me. But MVP, we've heard a lot about Steve Martin. I wonder if he will be making an appearance. Violet, let's go with your MVP.
Well, I hate to steal from you first, but it's got to be the music. It's got to be Alan Menken and Howard Ashman. They wrote the original show. I have to go back. I always go to this. Well, we don't have this movie if they hadn't written the show. So they're my MVPs.
Ian, was that also your?
Yeah.
The same. Yep. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. As soon as the music started and I was like, oh, I'm back.
Yep.
I'm back to where I was as a kid. I'm into it right away. I've said it again and again, this movie was just in me from a very young age, and the music is absolutely 110% the biggest reason for that.
Yeah. Bowden?
Am I in trouble? I keep getting my full name. I loved the songs. The songs are great. I'm going to go a different direction, though. I was very tempted by Steve Martin. Like, again, just knocked it out of the park. But I'm going to go with the Oscar-nominated team of Lyle Conway, Bran Ferren, and Martin Guttridge, who were credited with the visual effects. So Lyle Conway particularly designed Audrey 2, as you know, and then the other two obviously helped out with the other parts of the puppeteering and the visual effects. And we talked about how elite it was and how well it stands up 40 years later. The songs stand up well, and that stands up well. So I'm going to go with that team as the MVPs.
Equally valid choice, I feel. Seeing as we've got the music covered, I probably, if I was pushed to pick one person, I would probably have picked Howard Ashman. The lyrics are just on point. And yes, that's not to diminish what Menken did with the music. But yeah, lyrically for me, it's unsurpassed. However, with them having been looked after by the other two of our panelists, I'm going to shout out Frank Oz. He brought his expertise of puppetry. He brought everything that he'd done up to this point, which was The Dark Crystal and The Muppets Take Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought that sensibility and he just transported it into this Broadway musical. And it is, no other director could have made this in this way, because it is a Frank Oz movie.
Yeah.
And yes, you don't get the movie without the songs or the show and the visual effects, but there's one person at the helm of all of that. So I'm going to probably default to some sort of type and pick the director, because Frank Oz, I'm currently sitting about 20 miles from where Frank Oz was born. So I'm just going to shout out the man himself.
Good.
Love it.
The legend. Yes.
Absolutely. Well deserved.
A very Ian pick, actually. The director. Yeah. So I can see Ian nodding in appreciation of that pick.
Well, if you ascribe to the auteur theory, then the director has to go for everything. Any final thoughts from the three of you before we wrap this up?
I guess I'll just finish by reaffirming that I am very interested to see the director's cut, especially the ending. If I just watch the ending, it's basically like the same movie and then Audrey gets killed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So, yeah. The basic difference is Audrey getting eaten scene ends, like he pulls her out in both versions, and after that it's different.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll see if I can source that somewhere.
It's on YouTube.
It is. Yeah, you can watch
that. Sure, the whole thing is out there.
Thank you so much to Violet Hammond, to Ian Buckley, and to the man who is listed on our screen currently as Audrey 3, Bo Nicholson. And thank you to everyone that has tuned in. We very much hope that you've enjoyed the show. And if you have, please subscribe to Movieversaries and give us a rating and a review wherever you can. While you're here, you should check out the show notes. You'll find links to all of our things. Ian's got a plethora of podcasts on the Film Stories Podcast Network, things like We Are Starfleet, the Collector's Commentary, Illumination Above All will be coming back soon, hopefully very, very, very soon, because
for our Severance Head, yes please, yes.
I would love for the show to come back sooner rather than later.
I mean, you've got the connections. Nothing. Get on that.
Right, yeah.
Violet, you've got Adam. Three circles. And you're on We Are Starfleet currently, aren't you?
This week, yes, I am.
There you go.
Very exciting. Had a great time. I was in the academy paying attention. And I was a good student.
Very good. I believe that.
To record with you, yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. I was going to say unlike in school, but no, I think of the lot of us here, you are mine.
Very studious, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I can see it.
And Bo, you've got Academy Watch. Which is in full swing. I'm thrilled that you were able to make it here with us for this recording, because, like I said earlier, I wanted to re-tackle this movie, and to do it with the three of you has been an absolute pleasure. So thank you very much.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm also on Frame to Frame on a weekly basis. You'll find links to all of these within the show notes, as well as the Discord, where you can come and have a chat with us. Thank you again for your company, and we'll see you for the next installment of Movieverse.